Well, this evening, dear brothers and sisters, we are to continue our study of Romans, and it's my duty to speak to you tonight on man's depravity and God's righteousness revealed. And that's taken from Romans chapter 1, verse 18, through to chapter 3, verse 20, inclusive. I'd be very grateful if our brother Duncan Cook, please, could come forward and lead us in an introductory reading, and we've selected Romans chapter 2. Thank you, Brother Duncan, for that reading. Well, dear brothers and sisters, if we were to succinctly sum up the theme of this letter from Paul to the Romans, it could be described as a statement of the principles upon which God deals with mankind. And as such, it differs from most of Paul's other letters, in that it does not appear to have been written to address any local issues or concerns in the Roman Ecclesia. Rather, it contains universal truths applicable to all ages and regions, and as such, its teaching is especially relevant for us, as the nature of God and the nature of humanity has not changed in the intervening 2,000 years. The letter's theme demands that Paul first examines the characteristics of both God and his human creation as a foundation so he can build that he can build on to explain God's purpose through Christ and the required response from humanity. This foundation from chapter 1 verse 18 through to 3 verse 20 that forms our subject tonight, man's depravity and God's righteousness. The address falls into five neat sections. Firstly, the failure of the Gentiles in the second half of chapter 1. Then secondly, God's grounds for judgment, chapter 2, verses 1 to 16. Thirdly, the failure of the Jews, the remainder of chapter 2. Then fourthly, Jewish objections met, chapter 3, verses 1 to 8. And then finally, the witness of Scripture, chapter 3, verses 9 to 20. And so let us take these sections now in order, starting with the failure of the Gentiles, starting from verse 18 of chapter 1. The essence of Paul's argument in this section, down to the end of this chapter, is that mankind's ignorance of God is inexcusable, because even a cursory look at nature by a reasonable person will strongly suggest the existence of a higher creative and sustaining power, verse 20, for example. But the mass of humanity have always turned their back on the evidence and deliberately shut God out, instead worshipping things of their own making, mere images of the very creation that God has made, both human and animal. The result has been severe moral collapse, with a special emphasis on people satisfying their sexual desires in any and every way they see fit. This willful ignorance of God and his ways soon leads to a more general breakdown in society, verses 28 to 31, with dishonesty, greed, and violence predominating. And verse 28, and even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a reprobate mind, to do those things which are not convenient, being filled with all unrighteousness, fornication, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, debate, deceit, malignity, whisperers, etc., etc. Now, Paul would have been very familiar with this kind of society, possibly even more so than we are today. A quote about the moral state of the Roman Empire appears in Brother Carter's book, The Letter to the Romans, and I'd just like to read it to you because I think it really sets the scene. He writes, "A popular writer of today sums up the condition of the Roman world at the beginning of the first century AD thus. Look at the Romans. The Romans were in no decline like the Greeks. Theirs was a brave, magnificent world in its pride of power and mastery and success. But historians tell us that underneath this showy power and magnificence was a sink of rottenness. Family life was unspeakable. Tyranny and cruelty was rampant. The people were degraded and brutalized. Their favorite amusements were the hideous slaughters in the arena. Slavery was the curse of the empire. 2 men out of every 3 who walked the streets of Rome were slaves, and 2 women out of every 3 and 2 girls out of every 3 were the subject to every whim of their masters, to every suggestion of passion or lust. The slaves were wretched. The best of them crowded to Christianity when it came. The worst of them debauched Rome. They brought in new unnatural vices. They corrupted their masters. They corrupted their children. Every passion of the golden youth of Rome was ministered to by them. The Roman boys grew old and jaded and rotten with vice before they were out of their teens. A half century later, Paul indicates a position in his terrible first chapter of the Epistle to the Romans. God gave men up to uncleanness through the lusts of their own hearts. Another writer says this period suffered from deep religious and moral evils. Paul has in the first chapter of this epistle to the Romans drawn a night picture of contemporary civilized life, particularly that of the great cities, which to our shame, if it be spoken, stands without parallel save in the cosmopolitan cities of modern Christendom. Yes, and we think 21st century Britain is bad. Try living in Rome in the first century AD. If you think things can't get any worse, they certainly can. But of course, there are many parallels between our society and that of Rome. Indeed, that of any society that turns away from God. Eventually, it brings about its own ruin. In particular, the process in our modern world starts with the rejection of the notion of a supreme designer and creator. Many, if not most in our society, subscribe to the theory of evolution. And not surprising, given the steady, insidious message conveyed in the mainstream media, in books and in education, that evolution is a proven fact, an assumption which largely goes unchallenged as people assume the experts must be right and don't bother to look into the matter themselves. Indeed, I suggest that it's not too much of an overstatement to say that this rejection of the Genesis account of creation is at the root of much of the moral decline that we see today. Substitute creation with evolution, and you remove the need for a God. Remove God, whoever you think that may be, and you discredit the Bible's message as mere myths with no relevance to the modern world. And it's surely no coincidence that the start of the general drop-off in universal belief in God in the Western world occurred in the second half of the 19th century, in the decades just after Darwin's publications. Of course, it was a slow process, a process that is not complete yet today, but over the decades and centuries subsequent, society started to make up its own rules, ignoring the morals revealed by God. Just look at parliamentary legislation passed in most Western countries over the last 100 years. You will see that it is getting further and further and further away from God's truth, from God's standards. 100 years ago, for example, homosexuality was illegal. It's almost unbelievable, isn't it, to think that it was once illegal, whereas now it's openly championed and promoted as a good thing. Be proud of it. Although very few people bow down to actual images of people or animals nowadays, modern mankind has invented plenty of other gods. They idolize celebrities. They worship money and materialism. The fast car, the latest must-have gadget. Not so much different from verse 22. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man, and to birds, and four-footed beasts, and creeping things. Maybe exchange four-footed for four-wheeled beasts, and we have the modern world. And how many thank God for the abundance that most of them enjoy, for their homes, for their cars, for their holidays? Very few. And the next stage is, of course, to become debauched, just as the ancient Romans were. And so we see our society plunging ever deeper into the immoral abyss. Verse 24. Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lusts of their own hearts, to dishonour their own bodies between themselves. Verse 26. For this cause God gave them up unto vile affections, for even their women did change the natural use into that which is against nature. And like Rome, the end result is that we are seeing the whirlwind of violence and disintegration that Paul refers to in verse 29 onwards that we've already looked at. We note that although these things happen as an apparent natural consequence, they are in fact punishments from God on a world or worlds that have deliberately chosen to ignore God. Verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in righteousness. In unrighteousness. So the exhortation for us must be, brothers and sisters, for come ye out from them and be ye separate. Let's move on to our second section now. Chapter 2, verses 1 to 16, the grounds for God's judgment. In this section, Paul now sets out the grounds for God's right to exercise judgment on his human creation. He starts in the first four verses with a warning to those who would judge their fellow men or women that they have no right to do so if they themselves are guilty of the same sins they are condemning in others. In fact, such actions only highlight their own guilt. Verse 1. But God, in contrast, has a right to exercise judgment against his creation because he is absolutely righteous and beyond reproach. As such, his judgment is based wholly on truth, as set out in verse 2. Paul then goes on to show the hypocrisy of mere human judgment in verse 3, emphasizing that those who commit the very same sins that they are judging others on are in especial danger of God's wrath. Such people easily overlook the grace of God towards them, which, if discerned, would enable them to see their own need for repentance and redemption, as set out in verses 4 and 5. This reminds us of Jesus' warning to those with a plank in their eye trying to remove a speck of dust out of their neighbour's eye. It's the same principle. Paul's tone in this section is very direct, addressing his readers as you and your stubbornness, etc. It's in the first person. But I think this is more a sort of general style he's adopting rather than employing a tone of aggressiveness towards the members of the Roman Ecclesia personally. He's really addressing humanity in general. He's building up in particular to talk about the Jews' relationship with God, which we will cover shortly in the third section. But he's also stating that every human, whether Jew or Gentile, is basically faced with a simple choice. Verse 6. God, who will render to every man according to his deeds. And the rewards for obedience and the punishments for those who reject God will be the same for both Jew and Gentile. Verse 9. Tribulation and anguish upon every soul of man that doeth evil, of the Jew first, and also of the Gentile. But glory, honour, and peace to every man that worketh good, to the Jew first, and also to the Gentile. So God, despite his call of Israel to be a special nation in the past, does not show any distinction between the nations. What counts is how the individual responds to God's call, as set out in verse 11. Paul then goes on to support this statement in the remaining verses in this section, verses 12 down to 16. A superficial reading of verse 12 suggests that those completely ignorant of God will simply live their lives out and die unaccountable to him, whereas those who do know God are liable to judgment by God's law. However, while the former statement is taken in isolation is undoubtedly true, a careful reading shows that this is not what Paul meant in this context. Firstly, we have to view verses 12 to 16 as a whole. And verse 16 says that the perishing and the judging will take place at the judgment seat following Christ's return. But we know that those in complete ignorance of God will have no part in such a judgment. So how do we reconcile this? We're obviously dealing with two categories of people, those without law and those in the law, both of whom are sinners. Now, who are these to be identified with, and what law is Paul talking about? I must admit, I've not found an entirely satisfactory answer to this question, one that satisfies my own mind, even though I've consulted various commentaries, including some Christadelphian, that don't really seem to nail it for me, I must admit. But what I would suggest is that Paul, from verse 12, shifts his comments from focusing on the world in general to the ecclesia, in particular that in Rome. We know that ecclesia was a mixture of Gentile and Jewish converts. So could it be that those who sin outside the law are the Gentiles within the ecclesia, while those who sin under the law are the Jewish believers? Even this theory doesn't fit entirely, because it's a bit strange why Paul should suddenly shift his emphasis at this point. But in the sort of absence of any better suggestion, I might be interested to hear what other brethren think afterwards. If this theory is correct, it would be a warning to all that if they disobey the truth, whether from a Jewish or a Gentile background, they will be in danger of being rejected at Christ's coming. This is indeed, I think, one of Paul's more obscure passages, but my interpretation would seem to fit the following verses, verses 13 to 15, which I think are a parenthesis to what goes before. And here, Paul is putting the counter side, saying that those who do obey God's laws, not necessarily the narrow law of Moses, but God's commands in general, will be found righteous. And he's saying that this applies as much to Gentiles as to natural Jews. For example, verse 14, "For when the Gentiles which have not the law do by nature the things contained in the law, these having not the law are a law unto themselves, which show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and their thoughts, the meanwhile, accusing or else excusing one another." For such believers, the truth becomes written on their hearts, in contrast to the law of Moses that was written on tables of stone. And I think we have an echo of this sentiment in, if we just turn over a few pages to 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 3. Obviously, the Corinthians were predominantly a Gentile ecclesia, and Paul writes here, "For as much as ye are manifestly declared to be the epistle of Christ, written by us, written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God, not in tables of stone, but in fleshy tables of the heart." Anyway, I'd be interested to receive some comments on this afterwards. This leads neatly now onto the third section, the failure of the Jews, as described in Romans chapter 2, verses 17 to 29. Now, the Jews prided themselves on their supposed relationship with God, and it was a fact that God had separated them to be, in the words of Exodus 19, a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. The law of Moses was truly remarkable when compared to the laws of other nations, standing as a beacon of enlightenment in a dark pagan world. What nation is there so great that has statutes and judgments so righteous as all this law? Exclaimed Moses. If the Jews had kept it, other nations would have been moved to exclaim, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. But the Jews failed to keep God's laws. They broke the covenant, rejected God's messengers sent to correct them, and so were punished by the overturning of their nation and sent into exile. And the Jews' subjection to Gentile power was a testament to their collective failure to keep God's law. However, the Jew of Paul's day would not have seen it this way. Adversity fostered national pride to the point of xenophobia, and many of them hated and despised the Gentiles, being convinced that they were superior. Verse 17, behold, thou art called a Jew, and restest in the law, and makest thy boast of God, and knowest his will, and approvest the things that are more excellent, being instructed out of the law, and art confident that thou thyself art a guide of the blind, a light of them which are in darkness. Yes, if it had been done sincerely and honestly and faithfully, that would have been a very good thing. And that would have been excellent. But sadly, of course, as we know, the reality by Paul's day was somewhat less than ideal. But the Jews clung on doggedly to the elements that remained, the observance of the law, the priesthood, and the temple services. But a few years before Paul, Jesus himself had exposed the Jews' faith as phony. He had rounded on the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, who loved ritual but didn't see the spirit behind it. They had become obsessed with the mechanical ritual of the law and had assumed that their physical ancestry, we be Abraham's children, that sort of attitude would guarantee favour with God. And all the while they missed the spirit which lay behind the law, the goodness, the righteousness, and the justice of God. They saw the law as an end in itself rather than just a shadow of the good things to come in Christ. Such a narrow attitude led to gross hypocrisy. Verse 21. Thou therefore, which teachest another, teachest thou not thyself? Thou that preachest a man should not steal, dost thou steal? Thou that sayest a man should not commit adultery, dost thou commit adultery? Thou that abhorrest idols, dost thou commit sacrilege? Thou that makest thy boast of the law through breaking the law, dishonourest thou God? The Jews, armed with the law, should have known better. They condemned other nations for the very same sins they themselves indulged in. Verse 23 is perhaps worthy of comment. Verse 22. That phrase, dost thou commit sacrilege, is translated in more modern versions as, dost thou rob temples? Indeed, much as the Jews detested idols, their covetousness overcame their repugnance to the extent that they were willing to plunder heathen temples for the precious objects they contained. Indeed, there's a reference to this in Acts when Paul is making his defence in the theatre at Ephesus. He says that we've not come here to rob temples. It was obviously a fairly well-known, frequent occurrence that Jews did this sort of thing. Yeah, they detested the idols, but they weren't above making a profit out of them if they could. The Gentiles, amongst whom the Jews lived in the Roman Empire, were not, of course, slow to notice the contrast between the claims and the actions of many Jews. And by their hypocrisy, God's name was called into disrepute. Verse 24, for the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles through you, as it is written. And surely here, brothers and sisters, is a very powerful lesson for us. We as spiritual Jews have a personal lesson. It is easier and far more likely that our neighbours and colleagues will scrutinise our behaviour than they will examine the truth itself. If we declare that we are worshippers of God and that we are following his commands, how careful we should be to ensure that our actions are consistent with our profession. Otherwise, we too will bring the name of God the name that we bear into disrepute. The next few verses, 25 to the end, Paul considers the rite of circumcision, which was given by God to the Jews in addition to the law. It was a token of their covenant with him, both national and individual. But trust in the physical state of circumcision was misplaced if that individual's behaviour did not correspond with God's law. Circumcision in itself meant nothing, but was designed to remind each Jew of his obligations to God. But if he chose to ignore those obligations, it was as if he was not circumcised. Verse 25, "For circumcision verily profiteth, if thou keep the law, but if thou be a breaker of the law, thy circumcision is made uncircumcision." Conversely, the uncircumcised Gentiles in verse 26, if they obey God, Paul says, will be reckoned as circumcised, that is, in covenant relationship with God. Therefore, if the uncircumcision keep the righteousness of the law, shall not his uncircumcision be counted for circumcision? Such Gentiles who turn to God will turn the tables and reveal as false the natural Jews who rely on the physical act and state of circumcision. Rather, to please God, a man, whether Jew or Gentile, needs to turn to God with his whole heart, and outward signs and symbols such as circumcision are on their own ineffective. And surely, again, there's a lesson for us here, isn't there? The rite of baptism that we all undergo to come into the name of Christ, that is only a rite. In itself, it cannot save us unless it is accompanied by a change of heart, and a change of heart that continues with us for the rest of our lives. As is the breaking of bread, we can go along every week to the meeting and take the bread and wine in a mechanical sort of way, and it will not guarantee our acceptance with God, of course, unless it is matched with our actions the rest of the week. Moving on now to the fourth part of our study in chapter 3, verses 1 to 8. This effectively is Paul anticipating what we might call a Jewish objections to what he's just been talking about. As Paul well knew from his own experience, that a Jew would raise many objections to the conclusion he reached at the end of chapter 2. The conclusion being, in verse 29, "He is a Jew, which is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart in the spirit, and not in the letter, whose praise is not of men, but of God." Indeed, he may even have been thinking of some of the Jewish members of the Roman Ecclesia in what follows. So he preempts the four most obvious objections in what is effectively a question and answer section. Question 1. What advantage is there in being a Jew? Verse 1. The answer is in verse 2. Much every way, chiefly because that unto them were committed the oracles of God. The Holy Scripture delivered to Israel was and is unique. No other nation was so privileged. As the psalmist writes in Psalm 147, "He has revealed his word to Jacob, his laws and decrees to Israel. He has done this for no other nation. They do not know his laws." And while God's purpose will in time extend to all mankind, Israel was the subject of special promises, and it is through the Jews that God's purpose was focused. And indeed, when Jesus returns to rule the world, he will reign from Jerusalem, and Israel will become the head of the nations. Question 2. Contained in verse 3. "But what if some Jews didn't believe, as demonstrated earlier? Will their lack of faith nullify God's faithfulness to his promise?" The answer is in verse 4. "God forbid," or as in the NIV, "not at all." This was false reasoning. God, Paul argues, is totally faithful to his word. All the unfaithfulness, the wavering, the sin is wholly on man's side, and man's failure will not prevent God from executing his holy purpose, which will be revealed in those he judgeth worthy. Question three contained in verse 5. But if our unrighteousness commend the righteousness of God, what shall we say? Is God unrighteous who taketh vengeance? Some were forwarding the perverse argument that sin was good, as it showed God's righteousness more clearly, and that God was being unfair in being angry with such people who were effectively doing him a favour by allowing him to show his righteousness. Again, Paul dismisses the notion in the same strong terms as the previous question. He says, firstly, I speak as a man. And then, again, in verse 6, God forbid. God's righteousness in judgment is unquestionable, and he alone has the right to exercise it over his creation. How shall God judge the world? He continues. The logical extension of the previous question is in verses 7 to 8. Why not do evil and so bring about good? Paul need say no more in dismissing the notion than the words, whose condemnation or damnation is just. Such who argue are self-confessed sinners who deserve condemnation, not immunity from judgment. And now, moving to our fifth and final section, Paul sums up his arguments that we have covered tonight in verse 9. What then? Are we better than they? The we of verse 9 is generally accepted as referring to the Jews, and the they to the rest of humanity. To summarise, although the Jews did indeed have the great advantage of being the custodians, the oracles of God, this did not make them intrinsically any better people than the Gentiles. Continue reading verse 9. No, in no wise, for we have before proved both Jews and Gentiles that they are all under sin. But Paul anticipated further objections from his Jewish readers who might have countered, what? Are we Jews really under the rule of sin? We, who have for centuries lived under God's law? This just doesn't make sense. To answer such objections once and for all, Paul again proves his arguments by a mass of scriptural quotations in verses 10 to 18. As it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. There is none that understandeth, there is none that seeketh after God. They are all gone out of the way, they are together become unprofitable. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. Their throat is an open sepulchre, with their tongues they have used deceit. The poison of asps is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood, destruction and misery are in their ways. And the way of peace have they not known. And the reason really brings us back full circle to where we started with, doesn't it? There is no fear of God before their eyes, or no recognition of God. There are at least five separate passages linked together here by Paul, mainly from the Psalms and one from Isaiah. There is no need for us to turn them up. Most Bibles have the references listed in the margin. But if we did so, we'd notice that the quotes are not word for word, but rather paraphrases of the originals in the Old Testament. Perhaps we can imagine Paul striding around the room, these Old Testament passages tumbling into his mind as he dictated this letter to his scribe. And it's a little bit comforting, isn't it? Because so often we, if we're talking to interested friends or maybe doing a Sunday school lesson, we know the passage we want to quote, and we get the gist of it, don't we? We don't get it word perfect in our eagerness to convey it to who we're speaking to. And it seems like the Apostle Paul may well have been the same, just like us. He knew the passages, he could put his mind to them, but he sometimes slightly misquoted them from the original. But be that as it may, there is no doubt that this indictment And that's really what it is, isn't it, these eight verses, is slanted to refer to the Jews in particular. As Paul points out in verse 19, the articles of the law referred to those under it, that is, the Jews. Now we know that what things soever the law saith, it saith to them who are under the law. His object in this passage, on this whole section that we've considered tonight, is to show that the whole human race has been found guilty before God. Indeed, no one would argue that the Gentiles were unrighteous before they had accepted Christ. But he needed to show that the Jews were equally guilty of sin, despite having the law, and that the whole world, therefore, had no answer to God. That every mouth may be stopped and all the world may become guilty before God. The Jews were still trying to justify themselves by doing the works of the law and not seeing the need for faith in Christ. And so the conclusion of Paul's argument that we have looked at this evening is summarized in verses 19 and 20. Reading verse 20. Therefore, by the deeds of the law shall no flesh be justified in his sight, for by the law is the knowledge of sin. And we can sum that up in 5 points. No flesh, even circumcised flesh, can claim to be inherently righteous. Even keeping the law could not justify the Jew. The Jew had no inherent advantage over the Gentile, despite his possession of the law. In actual fact, the law brought the Jew to a knowledge of sin and so condemned him. And finally, so both Jew and Gentile stand equally guilty before God and quite unable to help themselves. Well, if this was the end of the story, we would, as Paul states elsewhere, all be in a most miserable state. But thankfully, it is not. For in the next section, Paul goes on to state how both Jew and Gentile can be justified before God through faith in Jesus Christ. However, that is a topic for another time.